Yeah, you're welcome a lot. So here comes our next episode. I was about to say issue, like this is a print issue people are going to read. Our next episode of Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast of the Armchair Dragoons. Tonight's panel, from left to right on your radio dial, we have our good buddy Captain Darwin. Jim, how are you tonight?
Not too bad.
Not too bad. So not too good?
I'd be happier if it was about 30 degrees warmer, but yeah.
Have some more scotch and you will be internally.
That's true.
See? I bring problems, not solutions. If you need some scotch, call our buddy Mirth. He'll be happy to not share his with you. Chris, how you doing?
I'm back.
Yeah? This is going to end up being like 3 or 4 weeks in a row.
It's crazy.
I know. Remember back when we had a co-host that wasn't you?
No, I don't.
Yeah. It's been a while. And then back for some more fun from the wild and woolly hills of Kansas. All two of them. Our buddy, James. How are you, James?
Hello.
Originally... We're gonna make fun of the Kickstarter process here. Originally, the plan was we were going to talk Cold War wargaming. We tried to time this to about when we thought the World at War 85 Kickstarters were going to actually start getting delivered. Hey, look, Dave wants to put a good quality product out, so they're taking their time getting the stuff to us from Lock and Load. But the stuff is literally on a slow boat from China and not here yet. And that's not going to stop us from covering Cold War wargaming tonight. We figure we've got a pretty good crowd to do that with. Do you have any Cold War stuff coming up in on the docket planned for CompassCon?
I might pick something up while I'm there. Our plan is to actually play Fields of Despair, which is World War One. So.
Yeah, all kinds of.
Bruce Maxwell is there to run NATO at Compass, so I'm going to at least stop by and see that.
Hang out, take a few pictures, ooh and ah, fondle some counters, get a restraining order issued against you.
Yeah, I'll try not to drool onto the table.
Yeah, you save that for podcast guests. So, Jim, we talked to you guys quite extensively about what's going on with Flashpoint Campaigns on a previous podcast, but I know Cold War wargaming has been in your blood for quite a while. Correct me if I'm wrong, you were one of the original developers slash playtester types before the original World at War series was released, not before it got rebadged as World at War 85, but the old Lock and Load original World at War Eisenbach Gap series, right?
Yep, going back to, I think it's about the same time I started up with Matrix at Origins in 07, hooked up with Mark Walker there, who was demoing his... new game there, which was Eisenbach Gap, and kind of went from there and pretty much worked with him on every release up to about, America Conquered or something like that. So a lot of work on counters and scenarios and initial map work and play testing.
James, I know you've got a handful of the Cold War-ish computer games hanging out in the library. Where are you on physical copies of Cold War war games? Like actual Hex Encounter-ish kind of things.
Well, I know that I've got a complete set of Assault sitting in the basement. We actually took it out and played it in the not-too-distant past. I've got not just one, but two as a backup, because I like it that much, copies of Air and Armor. Just got in a copy of GMT's Red Storm, haven't had a chance to play it yet, and unfortunately, if the fate of Downtown is anything to go by, it'll probably be a decade before I manage to get anybody to play with me.
Well, so Red Storm apparently has some solo scenarios in there, right, Chris?
Yeah, it shipped with a half dozen or so solo scenarios, and... You know, it looked. I haven't played it, but from reading the rules, it looked like the solo rules were pretty well developed. So,
yeah, I have not tried to play them yet. I haven't read the solo rules, but I'm glad to hear that. That will push me towards giving that a try.
Yeah.
Let us also note for the record that you have the good fortune of being married to someone who is not merely a wargamer, but on occasion, like, takes the initiative to bug you to want to play war games.
Yep, and you know what the really sad and horrible thing is? Inevitably, how often are we actually able to schedule to play a game together? It happens, it seems like, once in a blue moon.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating because somebody's tired or there's other things going on in life and so on and so forth.
Well, but plus yes. Your son's now getting old enough to join the game as well, depending on...
He is, although equally, he is also old enough that he has buddies he wants to play with online on his own computer.
Yes.
And so, it's the ironic situation, bizarre situation of three gamers in the house, but how often do we actually play with each other?
Yeah.
Not so often. Kind of weird.
So, James, you mentioned you just got out Assault not too terribly long ago. How well has it held up over the years?
It holds up in many ways really well. I first ran into Assault in the 80s when I was a teenager, and it was a game, and it was a system, and a couple of us played it. But I didn't have a lot of judgment on it one way or another at the time. And 30 years later, going back, it's a remarkably slick system. No surprise. It's a brainchild of Frank Chadwick. He tends to do very good design. But I know that on occasion some of us have battered at the notion of how would you build a modern-ish brigade-level war game, and we keep on cycling back towards, Chadwick did a lot of good choices about scale for ground and time and units and things to pay attention to and how to get things cooked down to their essentials. Is it perfect? Probably not. Nothing's perfect. But it runs pretty well. We had some new players in that particular game, and they were running Soviets, and they sort of ran units forward piecemeal and were getting them blown to bits. And they were getting frustrated by this. And so we talked through, what kind of tactics should work? Okay, so what would happen if you did that? Oh. So we start getting some infantry forward and spot for the artillery and put smoke in front of you. And now you can't watch us roll the tanks out to point blank range. And suddenly it's a really different picture.
One of the cool things with Assault is, hey, there were, if I recall correctly, there were four box sets that were released, right?
Yep.
There was Assault, yep. Boots and Saddles. Well, there were, Assault, Boots and Saddles, Bundeswehr, and Chieftain.
Yep.
And does the reinforcements pack count as a boxed set?
Well, it came as a folio, so.
So, no. Not really. But, I mean, it was an actual published set, though.
Yep.
So, five products in the Assault product line. But the last one, I think, rolled off the press in 88, 89. Probably, I don't think it lasted into the 90s, did it?
I don't think
in
so.
In terms of being printed.
I don't think so either.
But there's a very vibrant online community that has built out tons of orders of battle for other units, other nations using the Assault system. You can go fight the Chinese invasion of North Vietnam using the Assault system, where people online have just done a ton of support work with this, which I think is kind of cool. I checked out some of their work. I've oohed and aahed over some of the counters they've made, and some of them look like crap. Some of them look pretty nice. And some of the orders of battle that they were able to build out, I've not actually printed out and assembled any of them in order to use in a game at any point. But I've been impressed with the work that they've done behind that online community support. James, have you ever delved into that at all with your Assault
Only
games?
Only briefly.
Yeah.
The guy I know who has is Mark Graves, who shows up for the Origin stuff we do.
So was Mark doing it as professional research, or was he just interested as a gamer?
Oh, he was just interested in the gamer.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim, Assault system, played much?
Kind of like James, I've got all four boxes and the reinforcements over on my shelf. Played it more probably in my youth. I've taken them out and dust them off and look at it periodically, and kind of also used it back in the 80s as some groundwork for some of my own modifications and design stuff. And it's a nice parallel and a nice thing to look at, especially for like what we do with Flashpoint Germany and then Red Storm and Southern Storm, because you're basically the same time frame scale. So yeah, it's a good series. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I probably, if I had more people who could play it, I'd probably break it out if I had free time.
And one could make a pretty solid case that Flashpoint Campaigns is almost an evolution of a digital adaptation of many of the ideas from Assault.
I would say that's pretty close. The original Flashpoint Germany came to us via Simulations Canada stuff that Rob started. So kind of picked up on that. But I would say, my influences on things going forward in that series, probably peeled a number of things out of that series. I found it a lot more plausible than some of the larger scale World War III games that GDW had. But that's my comfort zone, is kind of right there in that tactical, grand tactical, anyhow. And then, like everybody else, I've got Red Storm sitting here behind me that I need to look at some point, with MBT and Wing Leader and a ton of other games behind me.
Well, we know Chris has at least opened Red Storm. Chris, do you have a full set of the Assault series still boxed in shrink somewhere in the pile?
I don't, but I'm going to get one.
Just to say you've got one, right?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go look and see what I can find.
Have you played it before?
I have some deep pockets.
Have you played it before, Chris?
I have not. I missed out. So now I'm intrigued as to what I've missed out on.
Well, I think one of the... James, jump in here because you can help correct me depending on how badly I mangle this. But one of the really nifty things about the Assault system was... something that Flashpoint, the Flashpoint series that Jim and others have worked on, has definitely really developed, and that is kind of the, not so much the variable initiative, but sort of the action cycle, wherein the Soviet model of you don't get to do too much too fast, but you get to do it in bulk, contrasts with kind of that NATO cycle of lots of smaller, quicker actions, so you're moving around faster, reacting a little faster, but you're not doing it as much in bulk because you don't have the bulk. Am I pretty close there, James?
That is what they're doing. I've never been entirely comfortable with that description in terms of looking at reality, but that's a rant or a discussion for a different moment, perhaps.
Yeah, and again, this is not to say that they necessarily modeled reality correctly. But that's what they were trying to model, and I think based on what they were shooting for, they were pretty successful
at it. They did it pretty well.
Yeah. Another game that does that very well, that's a newer design, is the Core Command series, Pete Bogdasarian's Core Command series, where your initiative number is your movement factor, and everybody at that number, you've got to be at that number and above to be able to move, so... For the Russians to really move quickly, you're not moving a lot of units. For the Russians to move a lot of units, you're not moving very fast.
His system is a die roll.
Yeah, there's a die roll with the modifiers.
You're rolling your initiative value or less, and the number you roll becomes your movement points.
Yep. And so because there's a lot of low-number Soviet units, when you hit those low rolls, you get to move a whole lot of guys. You're just not moving them very far. But you're right, it is more random in that game than it is in the Assault series, for sure. You mentioned Aaron Armor.
Yep.
So I'm assuming one of those copies is like unpunched and sort of wrapped in bubble wrap and shrink wrapped around that. And
yeah, pretty much.
Stored in a fireproof box.
Well, it's in a box in the basement at any rate. But yeah, I had the opportunity to get a second one cheap and decided not to pass it up. Number of years ago, but it is a game I have greatly enjoyed over the years and think pretty highly of. There's a lot of stuff in Aaron Armor that is highly unusual from the combat system on out, but it also produces both a really good game and a really interesting look at that era. It's sort of a division to core army level.
A lot of our listeners probably know what Assault is. I'm sure after, previous podcast appearance with OTS, they know exactly what the Flashpoint stuff is. Where does Aaron Armor live in the what echelon it's attempting to model, what scale we're looking at? And, look, it's all still Cold War goes hot in Central Europe. Like, that's the whole theme of what we're covering here tonight. But what is it that they're trying to model and describe in that game?
You got a chunk of Germany. If memory serves, it's 5 miles to the hex. Strength points of units are companies, so you're running typically, you're activating by brigade or division. You're often, the larger scenarios will have several divisions on the map, with Army assets coming in. So the larger scenarios run for several days.
Yeah, it's interesting that from the box cover and some of the ad copy, you almost think of it as something that's a lower scale than it is. And it's actually much closer in scale to the GDW Third World War. It's just barely an echelon below that.
Yeah, it's arguably two echelons below that, given that in Third World War, you've often got brigade and division level counters. In this, you're one of the many things that it does that's unusual is it will show you, here's the organization of your Panzer Brigade or whatever it might be. And they'll say, you've got so many steps of this kind of marker and so many steps of that kind of marker and so many steps of this other kind of marker. And then you're putting pollard markers, the rotatable strength markers, underneath those markers in order to add up to the given number of steps that you've got. So if you've got a typical Soviet regiment in that will have 9 steps and you've got 3 markers on the map, you could have 1 marker on the map with 9 steps. All 9 of the companies in the regiment are right there. Or you might have 3 with 3 or 2 of them with 1 each and 1 with 7. You might put one of your dummy markers under one of them and then have a 1 and an 8, however it is you want to divide it up.
Yep. It essentially, it mimicked the task organization without having to actually sort of recolor the different counters as you moved your task org around.
Yep. Possibly the oddest thing about that game, and for all that it's odd, it winds up producing some nifty effects that fall out of it, is the combat system in which you not only have the terrain that you're firing from affect you, you tot up all of your firepower against the other guy, and then their modified defense strengths wind up taking losses out of it. If you want to retreat, then it essentially absorbs the loss of the largest unit, the strongest unit type in the hex, as if it lost a step. Yeah. So you get a lot of terrain effects on different kinds of units out of that, so that your armor is better in the open and the infantry is better in the cities and so on and so forth.
I'll tell you, one of the things that caught my eye with Aran Armor when it was released, so I mean, we're talking 86-ish, I think, when that one was released. The counter graphics were actually kind of advanced for that time, with the way the spot color was printed on those counter sheets to give you some color coding below just, you know, brown is this and green is that and red is this. There was the use of some color coding for subordinate echelons. And that was kind of a big deal back then when we couldn't just digitize everything and get really snazzy with the graphics.
Yep.
And I know that was one of the things. Well, let's face it, like, cool flashy colors catch people's eyes. And that one did. That caught my eye at the exchange. Jim, have you ever played Aran Armor before?
No, that's not what I'm familiar with.
Haven't got there, Chris?
I haven't, but I'm looking at it on BoardGameGeek. It is surprising, like you were saying about the counters, and the maps would be good looking for 86, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And just for $180, you can get it on Amazon.
Yeah. Well, one of
$100 shipping.
It's in my cart as we speak.
Yeah, there's only one left in stock, so there you go.
Yeah, until after he orders it, and then there will be one left in stock, because somebody will hurry up and slap that in. One of the challenges you run into with Aran Armor, and with a couple of other Cold War war games that were pretty well-regarded designs, Fireteam is another one that comes to mind. They were well-regarded, nifty, innovative designs that allowed you to explore some nuances in the wargaming that got out from underneath the SPI model, basically, because SPI was doing a lot more Cold War stuff than Avalon Hill at the time. Because they were smaller printers relative to the SPI and Avalon Hills of the world, you didn't get huge print runs. And so now we're sitting here 30 and 35 years later, almost 40 years later, and you've got small print runs for well-regarded games that are old and, you know, fewer copies ever coming available. It drives the price through the roof. I don't know what the reprint rights holding would be for something like Aran Armor, but if anybody ever got a hold of it, there's some money to be made reprinting that one. Somebody at Compass probably ought to be investigating that one. There is a sort of reprint coming out for Fireteam with Steve's, you know, Mad Russian, Steve Overton's re-release of Fire Team Contact Now or whatever the subtitle. Jim, what's the subtitle on it?
Contact Now.
Okay. And Lock and Load's got that one coming at some point, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
They've been cleaning up rules and proofing counters and things, so we see that break the light of day early next year.
Yeah, that was the next question I was about to ask, is I don't think it's gone to press yet. So
I believe that's correct, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I didn't think it had gone to press yet. So that is one at least that is coming back around. Of the crew that we have on here, Jim, it may be a toss-up between you and me. I may be slightly ahead of you in the copies of Cold War war games sitting on the shelf over here. The first battle series from GDW, Team Yankee, and then later Test of Arms Battlefield Europe. Chris, ever pushed any of those around?
No.
Probably not. This is going to be a no theme for you tonight, isn't it?
Well.
We'll come back around to MBT for you in a minute and let you lord over us how you've already got your Canadian expansion for it.
Well, I do, and I mean, I'm just looking around. I mean, I've got Pack Air sitting over there. I've got almost a complete fleet series from Victory Games. So I'm not without Cold War games. Go back to the original point of the conversation. I do own almost the entire original run of the World at War games.
I was circling back around to that one eventually, but honestly, since the point of the call originally was going to be talking about them and they're not in our hands yet, if we didn't get back to them, then we still had them to talk about when we finally did get our hands on them.
I'm just saying, it's not like I don't own a few games, you know.
Just not any of the ones we're talking about that are all 40 years old.
Well, you guys, I mean, some of you guys are really old, so.
Wow.
You realize you're 2 years older than I am, dude.
I said some of you guys were really
old. Just smackety smackety.
Yes.
Yeah, I like to consider it well seasoned.
I think I own a copy of NATO. It may actually be packed away in a box somewhere.
Is that the Victory Games one?
Yeah.
It was a great lesson in some ways in broken design.
I didn't say that. I just thought I owned a copy.
Well, I've played it and a couple times, and if you play with the nuclear weapons rules, I got a brutal lesson from a friend as a teenager on the way in which it's broken. Namely, and to wit, that the Soviets go first. So the first thing you do as the Soviets is go nuclear. And you roll the die, and if you get a 4, 5, or 6, it's, I forget which end of the die roll it is. You know, you get the 4, 5, or 6, you say, okay, you won. Want to play again? And if it's not, you get the 1, 2, or 3, you use your nuclear first strike to annihilate NATO's nuclear capability, and then you win.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
It was a lesson, I guess. Something that I don't know if they decided was a just suitable thing that should be in the game as that's a lesson they wanted driven, or if they just never thought somebody would do it.
Which one was the war game that said that if it ended up going nuclear, you were supposed to light the map on fire?
I think that was Fire Team.
Is that what it was?
Spray the map with lighter fluid, light one corner, continue play.
Yeah. Yeah, there was one of it. I think you may be right. There was one of them out there that was that had the rules for nuclear combat in there. We should totally do an entire podcast episode on silly rules that found their way into, because everybody likes to make fun of the pasta rule from Campaign for North Africa, but somewhere in there there was a Civil War war game where you had to roll for a chance of leader casualties whenever a unit got hit. And if there was one particular unit in there that the game designer's great-great-great-grandfather served in, and so if there was a leader casualty in that game, in that unit, you had to immediately put the game away because the game designer never would have been born.
there was, I know it's not Cold War, but in the attack vector space combat game, there's the option to ram an enemy ship, but in order to do it, you have to give a speech, and the speech must convince everyone else around the table that the suicidal move of ramming the enemy ship is justified and you should go through with it.
There you go. That would be fun. Honestly, that sounds like the kind of rule your son would invoke.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, Chris, you've got the whole Fleet series sitting there.
I do.
I'm assuming that unlike much of your other collection, you've actually played the Fleet series at some point.
You'd be correct in assuming I haven't played it.
So,
well, here's the thing. I like both of James and Jim have noted, it can be difficult to find people to play these games with. And as much as I love the topic, few of my friends do. So though I take the games out and I read the rules and I gaze lovingly at it, wonder what it would be like to play it, it's hard to find someone to play it with.
I haven't made it through yet, huh?
No, and I mean, I think those games are great. I've read through the rules on all of them, and I do imagine playing them. But
the Fleet games I've never played. I keep on hearing good things about them.
They're highly regarded, which is the reason why I sought out copies of them. I have Fifth Fleet, which is the most highly regarded in the series, and I got that for a song. I mean, I felt a little dirty taking it from the guy for $20, but it didn't stop me from buying it, but...
That is, in fact, a ridiculously good deal there.
It wasn't mint, but it was unpunched and in very good condition. So, I don't think I have the entire series, but I have the bulk of it. I know I have fifth and second and at least one more after that.
Talk to us about the MBT collection you've got going there.
right in front of me, I've got the expansions for FRG and BAOR. I have the base game, and then I have the Canadians coming. We've played that. We played the base game, but we've done this too. I mean, we play a lot of Panzer and miniature, so we've done the same thing with MBT. And half the reason that I own the games is just for the cards, the data cards, to be honest. Because, well, it's as silly as it sounds. I have a friend who has all this stuff in like 10 mil. So, we'll play it. We'll play the scenarios and we'll use the data cards, but we're more likely to play a miniature than we are actually to play the board game.
Which, what minis do you use? Just standard GHQ micro armor, or is there something else you guys do?
I'm not sure what the company actually is. I know my friend just buys these things up. You know, he goes on a buying spree, and all of a sudden he has, you know, like an entire set for the Soviets, and, you know.
Yeah, no idea what that could possibly sound like. You know, people going on a complete buying bender.
Yeah, I wouldn't know what that's like. I don't have the minis. I mean, I play these things. The same thing with Panzer. We play a ton of Panzer in like 10 mil. I own big stuff. I own like 28 World War II. So, but I'll sit there and I'll play with other people's figs. If they put them down in front of me, I'll push anybody's lid.
That sounds almost a little dirty.
Yeah.
I don't know. You could view it as being very charitable.
Or that.
Well, in this hobby, people have all this stuff, and all they want is someone else to play on the opposite side of the table.
I just want someone to play with.
Please play with my toys.
All right, World at War 85. We'll go ahead and get there. So, Jim, obviously you've been around the development of it quite a bit. James, I know you've pushed a couple of counters around on it. How much time or effort have you expended into playing some of the World at War series?
Oddly enough, not a lot. I know that Jim introduced me to it, so I've got a basic concept of how it works rattling around in my skull, but I've not spent a lot of time playing it.
Chris, I know you own a bunch of them. How much of it have you played?
That is one that we have played quite a bit, or we did play quite a bit a few years ago. And I really like the system. I'm glad they're doing the reissue. My issues with the game were kind of on the technical side. The counters were very dense for information. That wasn't, to put it politely.
Yes, they are.
And some of that information came down to what color the line was under a tiny little number.
And a tiny little number in an 80s Bauhaus font you couldn't read, where the threes and the fives were interchangeable.
Yeah,
that was a little rough.
I love the game system. I own most of it, and I have a friend of mine who I think owns the complete all of them, everything in the series. And we played various ones of them extensively, and we like the system a great deal. So I'm pretty excited that it's getting the update and being cleaned up. There was also for a game that didn't have a lot of rules. Sometimes the rules were confusing. So I'm happy that those are getting kind of cleaned up too.
One of the issues that I had with the World at War series was a design decision that Mark had made early on. I understand what he was after, but the net effect within the wargaming community just kind of pissed a lot of people off. That was the issue of changing up the available force mix to where you didn't have full units in the counter sheet. I get that within the scenario, you're going to want to task organize units. You're going to want to have depleted units, units that had suffered some attrition throughout the early stages of the battles, depending on when in the war the game takes place. I get all those things. But to ship the game without all three mech platoons in the mech company, without all, then five line companies in a mech battalion, because you had the ITV company as well, to ship a tank battalion without the companies all having their full complements of platoons in there, because you were accounting for attrition ahead of time, that just seemed like a bad, because it limits the ability of the community to create their own scenarios. It limits the ability of your players, your fans, to help build the community and what you're trying to play there. And that just seemed like a counterproductive decision coming from the printing press.
I think the funny thing there is you just hit counterproductive. Well, part of that too was just production of counters.
Yeah. I wasn't intending to be that glib.
The original series was small.
Yeah.
Saying that if you put a full unit in the counters, they just weren't going to hit the map because of real estate. You just didn't have the room, and then they're into that quandary of, well, do I print the extra counter sheet, which is extra cost? They're not getting put in scenarios because the maps are smaller. Until you started to expand it out, and if you see what they're doing with the new, World of War 85, is they're putting bigger maps out there. They've got the money and the time and the dollars to put kind of a fuller, larger scale battle on a map. So having those fuller forces made sense. It was a decision, and trying to keep it small, trying to keep the cost down, just trying to fit the narrative. And you're correct; it kind of left holes. Now some people got smart and made their own additional counter sheets and put them out there, and made bigger maps and things. Started using pulling out the maps from the Assault series and playing the game on there. We're gamers. We use what we have.
But part of it gets back to, should you have to do it that way? And I think that was the frustrating thing for folks, is that here you've got this nifty design that's got some great potential in the way in which the game can be played, and you're hamstringing your fans by limiting the tools you're giving them in their toolbox And then making it very hard to read the counters.
If I had to go back and tell him anything from the start, it would be don't use that font, because the 3 and 5 thing was a killer, and trying to deal with underlines and. The horror stories that I could tell about, like the untold stories, and a number of times that we went through looking at the counters to proof them, because the software that was being used to put them together, you'd go back and say, this is missing an underline, this 3 should be a 4, and then you come back and look, and oh, those got fixed, but then 3 other things that were fine are broken. I think we were 14, 15 sweeps through the counters deep to get that stuff through. And if you look at Mark's stuff too, the first games were very, a couple counter sheets and small maps, and, got the bigger map in Blood and Bridges and some more counters. And then you started getting more and more counters and, some bigger stuff as the series went on. And I think if he had started that series maybe later in his Lock and Load days, it may have had a bigger footprint at the start. But, I mean, that was the game coming out of the gate that kind of got the ball rolling between that and his Band of Brothers back in the day.
I think there were a lot of really cool ideas in the game, in the way in which it was a bucket of dice kind of game, which was fun.
Yep.
But it was a bucket of dice kind of game that still had some smart mechanics underneath it to differentiate the ways in which we thought things would work between the different kinds of forces. And that was good. It's going to be really interesting to see how the rebooted Lock and Load reboots the World at War series, because they've got a fantastic product there that I think was unfortunately the victim of some poor production decisions. And Jim, you've already articulated those. We don't need to rehash them.
Right.
But I think lots of folks are looking forward to, okay, what do we have next? And can't wait to get it in their hands. I wanted to ask a couple of broader Cold War wargaming questions to the panel here, and I'm sort of curious where you guys come down on these things. Generally, when we're talking about Cold War wargaming, we're talking about Cold War goes hot in Central Europe, where everybody was facing off across the inner German border, and the immediate extensions of that theater. So, for instance, the GDW Third World War series of games that you could connect. You had the Northern Front that took you all the way up to the Norway-Russian border, such that it was. I mean, it was, 12 miles wide, maybe? you had the southern side. They got you Italy and the Balkans. Was Turkey on that map anywhere? Anybody remember?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was, as far as whatever they did for that southern...
Yeah.
Southern...
And then you had the Persian Gulf one, which was more about fighting stuff in the Persian Gulf that kind of grafted some Third World War stuff onto it. But you could still extend it end to end. But still, essentially, the primary theater of war was Central Germany, and then let's build, it's expand from there. When we're looking at other places the Cold War could have, or in some cases did go hot, do we consider Vietnam War games to be part of Cold War wargaming, Chris? What do you think?
Yeah, I do. I just not in the context that we're talking about, but yeah, I consider that Cold War wargaming.
But I mean, if somebody says, "Hey, we're gonna talk about some Cold War wargaming stuff here," is that one of the things that pops to mind?
No, I mean, everything is so focused on the war that never was. I mean. So I think it gets lost in that. I mean, when you bring it up and pose the question to me, yeah, I consider it. But that's not what comes to mind when you say, hey, we're going to talk about Cold War wargaming
tonight. Yeah, yeah. Well, and part of that, too, is kind of a marketing thing. Hey, the new Vietnam game from Andy Starkweather, right? You're not describing that as, hey, the new Cold War game that takes place in Vietnam.
But I would extend that and say, the actual Korean War stuff doesn't pop into my head either. which is pretty much as Cold War as it gets.
Yes, it was cold in Korea during the war. James, do we draw those lines because those other discrete conflicts have specific names to them, or do we just lump it all into Cold War wargaming as anything anywhere from 1946 to about 1992?
Well, as Chris said, you can make a intellectually valid argument that all of them are in the Cold War from sort of 48 through 91. But if it's going to be on something that happened, then I expect people to say, oh, it's going to be this war, that war, the other war. Whereas you say Cold War to me, and I'm thinking it's either going to be a strategic nuke game, or it's going to be Central Europe, here we go, or it's going to be the U.S. and Soviet fleets duking out in the North Atlantic or the Pacific or something. As he said, it's the war that never was when you say the Cold War.
Or we could say, something really nasty and say, think of Twilight Struggle.
True.
Not a war game. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Shut up.
You knew as soon as somebody mentioned Twilight Struggle, somebody was going to say it. It might as well have been me.
That's why I said I could get nasty.
Well, so similarly in those discussions, Gulf Strike, Light Division, some of the hypothetical conflicts at the time they were being published were hypothetical conflicts that involved the U.S. showing up in the Persian Gulf. I don't necessarily consider those Cold War. They may have been proxy fights at best, but I don't know that those were necessarily Cold War goes hot kinds of things.
Well, they were by implication, because both Gulf Strike and Aegean Strike, you could wind up going toe-to-toe with the Soviets.
You could, yeah. Yes. So.
Yeah, and I think that's where you've got to make that distinction, is when you say Cold War, you're looking that you have to have a component of the United States and a component of the Soviets. And that's why I think when you look at things like your Korean War, Vietnam, any of the brush wars, South Africa's, Angola's, other places where people were fighting, it was in that time period. But that's, to me, it's not the Cold War. You definitely have to have that U.S. and Russian confrontation to kind of pick those up. So. Aegean strikes, like you said, the other ones. Yeah, if the U.S. was there and you could bump into Russians, you can lump that under Cold War, I think.
One of the Aegean strike scenarios was Cold War goes hot. Yeah.
At the time that Gulf Strike was put out, I mean, that was still a hypothetical when it was released,
Yep.
Yeah, for all of 6 months.
Well...
And then there was the Desert Storm expansion while the first print run was still on shelves.
I know.
Sometimes you get lucky.
And a war based on your game breaks out.
Well, I can still remember in the early 80s the rush to hurry up and get a bunch of Falkland War games out in 82-83, right around the time that the Falklands had just broken out and had just wrapped up, actually. There was a mad rush.
There isn't really much there to choose from. I mean,
probably 50% of the Falkland games that ever got printed were printed within, the first 18 months after the conflict, and the number of them since then has not grown all that great, right? There's Discord, Hero of the Falklands, maybe a half a dozen others, but not many.
I looked because I would like a good Falklands game, and I would like one that's not solo, first of all. But what I found is, what's out there is, it's so old that it's not really palatable to play.
I think the White Dog Games guys have one out there.
Yeah.
Palatable in what way?
Just old looking.
So ugly as opposed to badly designed.
Yeah, that's the way to put it. I wasn't going to say it quite that. No, you're right.
When we call Chris a game whore, it has multiple connotations.
And I don't want to, look, I own plenty of older games, which are not up to the modern standards of graphics, so I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but I'm just making the point. I mean, I know the gold standard for Flopplins is where there is Discord, but I don't want to pay $200 for a solo game.
We all know somebody who would.
I know several people who would, but I'm not one of them.
It can be, part of the problem, though, is for a relatively small conflict like that, what's the actual market out there that would cause a publisher to say, hey, this is worth taking the plunge on and getting something printed?
I don't know. All yeah. I'm saying is I really don't need another Bulge game, and they keep pumping those things out like there's no tomorrow.
And you keep buying them.
Well, yeah, that's true.
So
there is that.
At a certain point, it's not the crack dealer's fault. At a certain point, the addict has to take some responsibility here.
Oh, I do.
Are you single-handedly keeping Bulge games in print?
I hope not. I really don't. But, and hey, look, I didn't pee 500 Time for Trumpets. I will buy it when it comes out, but I didn't pee 500.
Yeah, you don't pee 500 anything, though.
Not these days, I don't.
I am the shelf of games from across the room here for some of the other Cold War discussion points. You know, the first battle series from GDW that included Test of Arms and Battlefield Europe did in fact include some fairly amusing potential scenarios. One of them had a Belgian Civil War go hot. So you got to fight the Flemish versus, you know, the rest of the country. And there were actual scenarios built around that one. That was fairly entertaining to read. I can't imagine the scenario was a whole lot of fun to play, but it was at least entertaining to read. Go back in time a little to games that were sort of being designed contemporary to the Cold War itself going on. Backing up a little bit, some of the SPI catalog had some great Cold War Goes Hot kinds of games, thinking of things like MechWar 77, NATO Division Commander, the Fifth Corps series, some of the Mod Quad series. James, are there any of those that you think back on particularly fondly?
Most of them I never got a chance to play, but I still have a copy of NATO Division Commander. Managed to play it against myself, including in some masterpiece of schizophrenia. I played it against myself double blind, which is in some ways kind of cool.
That's impressive, I will say.
The key to it is that you have to sit there and say, okay, I had a plan. The plan was X. What I know is Y. And you have to refuse to take into account anything that you can't derive directly from what's on the map in front of you. Which in some ways means that you are more crippled than you would be if you were playing against an actual human, because you're turning off any intuition you'd have about the situation. In some ways, NATO Division Commander is really cool. It was a nice attempt to force people to understand chaos and the amount of time that it takes to do things, the time to shift units from march to hasty attack to deliberate attack to prepare a deliberate attack, let alone, you know, so on and so forth. And yet there's other aspects of it which frankly seem underbaked. I've never been able to figure out why they have two chain CRTs as opposed to do the bloody math and move them together into one. Because the net impact of the first one on the second is minuscule. So why are we bothering? I never understood that. It's a neat thing that they tried it. And I've heard rumors over the years that at least for a while the CIA was using it with junior analysts to say, this is why things go wrong in military operations, because it showed friction well, supposedly. That's a rumor. I don't know it for sure.
They should have just sent him to NTC for a week.
Well, you know,
again, things have probably happened.
Well, how many junior CIA analysts are going to get sent to NTC?
Well, probably none, but if the whole point is to show people why things go wrong in military operations, that's not a bad way to do it. Like, go watch these guys screw this up.
The problem with sending them to NTC would be the difficulty of getting them to see the why of things going wrong.
Yeah.
To put them, to be able to reliably put them in a place where they can see the plan from plan to execution and see that it's going wrong and not say, oh, well, those guys were just jacked up, and come to the realization that it's not that they were jacked up or just that they were jacked up, but that things will go wrong.
Yes.
Whereas when it's their own plan, then they can start to see the friction in action.
And feel it all inexorably go wrong, watch it go wrong, and not be able to keep it from going wrong.
Or they could sit down with me for 10 minutes at any game I've ever played, and they could experience that same exact thing.
There is that. That is a valid option.
Less expensive than sending them to NTC.
Perhaps. There's not a great expense with sending someone to Barstow. There's just not.
That's a good point.
It doesn't cost a lot to send somebody to Barstow for a little bit of time. Last topic / question in there. Do we lump the Arab-Israeli wars into Cold War stuff? Or is that just a giant proxy fight with religious overtones that we'd rather all stay out of?
Again, I think because it's not, again, Cold War main bad guys and belligerents. No, it's its own thing. It's got its own name. It's had its own set of wars. You know, it happened in the time frame again, you know, post-World War II, but it's kind of its own deal.
Yeah. It's kind of where I come down also, but it's a lot of the same equipment sets. It's some pretty clear East versus West battle lines that are drawn in the sand there.
And it's a decent, I'll say, kind of analog to U.S. and Russian equipment and tactics and things, but you know, they kind of also did their own thing, and yeah, it's got its own name. I would let it go with that. And, yeah, eventually one of these days, you know, we'll have a Flashpoint campaigns over there with the Mideast stuff again. But
okay, so I'll play the trumpets when I edit this together. But breaking news: Flashpoint Campaigns has a planned Middle East expansion. I'm going to announce that in the Matrix forums, and you're going to start getting nonstop questions.
I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Quick side note. Yeah, a little funny, but we, you know, went to the Red Storm, came off of work we did for a didn't-really-see-the-light-of-day Mideast game that we were working on in between Flashpoint Germany and Red Storm. We got to a point where it was just not gaining the ground we wanted and trying to deal with, you know, want fun, Arab-Israeli Orbats anytime from 48 up to the 90s, trying to find one that's even remotely correct. And TOEs, because that stuff is just hard to come by, kind of ground out. So we'll get back there eventually.
James, you know the stuff sort of east of Poland better than the other three of us on the call combined. Is the current situation around the Ukraine that is spawning our current Putin's war games and the games like the Donetsk game coming out of the Taktika and Strategika, I know I'm butchering the Polish pronunciation of it all. Is this really a sign that for war gamers the Cold War never quite died, or is this a whole new series, a whole new era of gaming that our grandkids are going to be looking back on, and they're going to draw the line on the Cold War at 91, and they're going to start a new one somewhere in 2000 blah, and go forward with Cold War Mark II?
Yes.
Okay.
So, a more detailed answer. Because there's elements of all of that. So, in some ways, it's Cold War Mark II. There's enough of a break in the 90s that, to me, it feels like a new round. And it's far less ideologically driven. There's not that monolithic block of there you have the communist countries, and here you've got the capitalist countries, and they're competing in every conceivable domain to try and prove their system is better. That dynamic is gone. For all that, many of its bits and bobs are still lying around. We've still got all those nuclear missiles, and they're still presumably pointed at various other places on the planet. So in some ways, it's Cold War II, but the dynamic of it has changed a lot with things like the Grey War. The entire means by which the Russians took Crimea is not something I think you would have seen in the Cold War, where you've got this force that's deniable until you decide to acknowledge it. Once it's created facts on the ground, nobody's quite willing to go after you, but – and then you rip up and ignore a treaty you'd signed two decades before that said you'd respect the territorial integrity of a given country when they gave up their nukes, and rip a province off of them. Bam.
Yeah.
That's not a dynamic I think we would have seen between the great powers in the Cold War. The other thing that is changing is the mix of technology and what's in there. There are layers at which the mid-Cold War and the later Cold War are more analogous to World War II than they are to the modern day, because the range and depth and lethality of the systems keeps on growing, which is driving not only dispersion, but it's complicating the problem. And on top of that, you can argue back and forth over whether or not cyber warfare is or is not an extension of the prior electronic warfare. And there's a good case to be made for why yes it is, and there's an equally good case to make to say, oh no, it's not, that there's a qualitative change in the nature of the whole cyber contest. But in that and in the increasing ability to influence people through distributed broadcast, if you will, through the internet, as opposed to merely, hey, I've got a big radio station or TV station, the centralized broadcast of the earlier era, is steadily changing the face of how warfare seems to work. Now, if we really wind up in a whatever we're calling this thing goes hot situation, some of that may well change, particularly on the ability to influence with broadcast. But hopefully we won't get to find that out.
I think one of the big changes in the information space is up until 91, basically the wall coming down. So 89 when the wall came down, but you know, 91, 92 after the German reunification, is you had two very stovepiped, intentionally segregated information spheres where the Soviets were terrified of Western propaganda, as they saw it, seeping into their populations. And I think today, not only do they not fear that, but they've realized that by intermingling those information systems, they're having a much bigger effect on us than they ever suspected we would have on them. And I think that's a huge change that nobody saw coming, and nobody's really sure what to do with it or what to do about it. And that's probably somebody's doctoral thesis somewhere, is my guess. but I think you're right.
The component to that that's changed is that, you know, it's just so easy to doctor stuff now that the average person has no way of distinguishing that between a real thing. I mean, I can personally say that if I see something that's coming out of the Ukraine right now, I don't have any way of accurately determining whether, like, a YouTube video is a genuine thing or not.
Yeah, and this is where, let's face it, some of us, because of our wargaming connections, or in some cases some professional connections, have the ability to check some of these things a little easier. James and I have a mutual friend that's prior military and used to work with James at one point, that is on the ground in Ukraine right now working as an observer. And if we see something that seems a little questionable, there's nothing stopping us from shooting an email to him saying, hey, what's going on? I'm intentionally not naming him because we didn't ask him if we could call him out on this. But we have that luxury that a lot of people don't have. The flip side of it is, a good friend of mine, a guy that was in my wedding, does a lot of business in Ukraine on behalf of the U.S. government. He hates it when I describe him like this. He's an arms dealer. He says he hates when I call him that because he's like, dude, you make it sound so nefarious. I'm like, you import, export, you know, former Soviet weaponry for the special ops guys to train with. Like, what else are you if you're not an arms dealer? But again, he has some contracts on behalf of the U.S. government to deliver certain things to folks in Ukraine. So it comes back to, if I got a question about something's going on, I can call him and say, hey, how legit is this? Because he's been on the ground in the last 6 weeks.
Right.
And that's a luxury that we have that many people don't. James, I do want to come back, and I know we're starting to stretch time a little bit here, but I want to come back to your point about the change from Cold War take one to today, that there was, it was more ideologically driven before. You know far better than I do, obviously, but I do want to ask the question, are we seeing it as ideologically driven because that's what we were told all along at the time? Or was that ideology simply covering up some other form of Soviet adventurism? Was that just a blanket excuse for them to try to get away with things?
Yeah, if you really get into the Soviet point of view on that, then in fact the Cold War is a defensive action from their perspective. Because from their perspective, they're born in fire in the Russian Civil War, which, although we tend to forget it, included invasions by the British, the French, and the Americans.
Yep.
There was combat between, you know, our various forces and theirs on a fairly small scale because all of the Western powers were eager to get back out. A variety of the forces that they are fighting full scale in the Civil War are being funded and supplied by Western powers. They're squaring off against all of the Western powers and the Japanese throughout the 20s and 30s. And one of the threat studies that has come to light, Tukhachevsky writes a threat study in 28 called Future War, Budushaya Vojna. And the two basic scenarios are either the West is going to come after us by using its puppet states, Germany and eastwards, or the West comes after us and they're fully engaged. So do you want the bad scenario or do you want the really bad scenario from their perspective? And as the Japanese rose and got bumptious, they saw that as a threat as well. And then having done their best to more or less stay out of it through the ultimately somewhat disastrous deal with Hitler, which came about only because they could not come to an agreement with the West. The Soviets and the West couldn't – they were negotiating for some kind of a alliance or deal, and they couldn't trust each other enough to do it, which is why eventually the Soviets said, screw it. At least we can come to an agreement with the Germans. So they took it. They wind up in what is by itself the largest war in human history in the Eastern Front. And they're also, while they're at it, they're fighting the Japanese, you know, before and after that goes on. They are sending vast amounts of aid to the Chinese nationalists to fight the Japanese. So from their perspective, at the end of World War II, the grabbing a series of buffer states out through to Germany is self-defense. And as they run into various actions of ours, ranging from, you know, Patton flying off the hook about why aren't we attacking them, or they got pretty pissed by the fact that we weren't willing to put war criminals such as Heinz Guderian on trial, and we are doing things that they see as potentially hostile in organizing the Western states. So they start going back. Does it hurt in that Stalin is thoroughly paranoid? No. Now, I'm not going to lay the entirety of the blame on either side. But they do see that as, how do we defend the country? And ironically enough, it is that ultimately is a major factor in breaking them. The amazing thing about the Soviet economy is that in many ways it manages to sustain a near war footing for the duration of the Cold War.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because for all of that time, with a exception right around with Khrushchev and right towards the end, if the military said it needed things, then generally it got whatever it asked for, because if the politicians started to say, hey, we need to build other parts of the economy, the military would say, well, do you want a repeat of 1941? No, thank you. We all lived through that, so let's not do that. So then give us what we want. The impetus for putting missiles in Cuba was trying to prove that nuclear deterrence would keep the Americans contained. Well, it failed.
Yeah.
So that meant that Khrushchev then could not shrink the army and move more of the budget to butter instead of guns.
Yeah. Our Pershing IIs in Germany sort of proved that notion wrong as well.
That's the whole thing. If you look at it from their perspective, putting missiles into Cuba was no different than what we were doing on their own borders.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And, missiles in Turkey. And we traded the missiles in Turkey, which we were already going to pull out, for the missiles in Cuba. The other thing in the Soviet collapse that we tend to forget is the role of the Saudis, because the Soviet economy is being propped up by sales of oil. And yeah. When the Saudis, after the oil crisis, decide to keep the oil price worldwide at a level that is convenient for us, it also winds up kicking their oil exports right in the pocketbook. And it means that they are no longer able to sustain the economy that they've been running. The clock starts to run out.
Well, to your point, James, it is impressive that they were able to keep their military, basically stay out of war footing for as long as they did on an economy that was simply just not as efficient or, you know, large as our own. You know, you look at what they did in the 60s and 70s with actually building a blue water navy, which they did not need at all, but they did it, you know, to a degree. I'm not saying, you know, not that they ever were close to matching, you know, NATO or us, but they fielded an impressive blue water navy for a while.
Yep.
Yep.
In a sense, the analog might be North Korea now, which is in the process of becoming a nuclear power at whatever cost.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Just since the resurgence, if we want to call it Cold War II, that's fine. We talked previously when we had Joel on the podcast. That, you know, again, from the Soviet point of view, like you said, you know, you got us up through Cold War. They'd been invaded, you know, 3 times in 100 years, 120 years leading up to World War II. But even since then, all of the stuff that they had supposedly feared through the 60s and 70s, once the Soviet Union fell apart, how many former East Bloc countries are now members of NATO? You know, you've got this NATO expansion that's now brought them up even further to the Soviet borders. You've got us, the pro-Western protests in the Ukraine going on. There's this endless litany of, from their perspective, Western encroachment on their sphere. And you mentioned Stalin's paranoia. My dad spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union, speaks Russian, was a East European fail and all that. He's mentioned that paranoia is almost sort of a national trait for the Soviets. It's not limited to the leadership. The leadership comes out of the rest of the country as well. And that level of paranoia is not limited just to leadership. And there are the list of times in which we've justified their paranoia is not a short list. So
no, I mean, even what you were just saying about, you know, our encroachment east. I mean, there was a time during the Cold War, you know, where there were decided spheres of influence, and you know, post Cold War, we have definitely moved into what was considered their sphere of influence.
Yeah. After telling them we wouldn't.
Well, that's kind of, yeah, exactly. And, you know, and also to what you were saying, their leadership, I mean, their current leader is, you know, a product of the Cold War.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so are ours.
the longer term thing to consider there is that in many ways, Eastern Europe moving to our sphere of influence is a kind of chickens coming home to roost. In general, if you have an occupation forced upon you, then at some point when it is lifted, you generally do not wind up saying, gosh, the occupiers were great people and sticking with them.
Oh, sure.
And one of the longer things to ponder is the degree to which strategies based around coercion of a target are short-term effective and long-term disastrous.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah. That's an excellent point.
And so,
I just want to be clear. I'm not defending the Russian position on these things. It's just, if we're going to play devil's advocate and look at it from their point of view, you can see where, some of the, quote-unquote paranoia comes in on it.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are trying to justify the Russian viewpoint.
No, and I don't think we were. It's definitely one of those situations where the chickens come home. And to James's point, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong on this, but at least as far as what, from my point of view as a layman, what I've read, I don't think there's any question that if the Russians made a move, whether NATO got involved or not, the Poles are certainly not looking to become, members of the new Russian Empire under any circumstances.
Not willingly.
Yeah, no, I mean, we can sit here and, under the current, environment, speculate on what NATO's response would be, but I'm pretty sure that the Poles would, fight.
Yeah, mass mobilization. I will say this, because we're hitting the time marker here for how long. Look, let's face it, it's not just that our audience can always hit pause and come back to it. At some point, I got to edit all this crap together, right? So at some point, I got to hit an end point just for my own editing's sake. I want to leave on this quasi-provocative thought here. James, you mentioned that occupiers, that the occupied locations seldom look back at the occupiers and go, hey, gee, thank you, can we have some more? What would the implications of that be for Reconstruction in the United States post-Civil War? I'm going to leave it at that and say, Jim, thanks for being with us tonight. Appreciate your insights on, especially on the World at War series. Chris, have fun at Compass Con, and I guess we'll talk to you in a week and get the wrap up on that.
Stop by and ask Bruce Maxwell if he's fixed the issues with the nukes in NATO.
Yeah, please do that and get back to us and remind Gary that he had committed to talking Compass Con with us after the fact also.
But Gary's going to be there. Oh, cool.
Yes, somebody you like will be there. And James, thanks as always for being the smart guy in the room and making the rest of us feel like complete amateurs. So
yeah, right.
And audience, thank you for joining us and joining James as being the smart guys in the room so that me and Chris and Jim can just sit over here and make smart ass remarks. And
that's what I do every week.
Yeah. So we will talk to everybody in a week or two as we start to wind down this season. We appreciate you joining us on this episode of Mentioned in Dispatches, and we'll be back in a couple of days with another one.